thought exercise for you now. Imagine the ancient Greek philosopher Plato in the U.S. today on a book tour. It could happen. The most influential philosopher in Western history. How influential? Well, one modern authority said the last 24 centuries of philosophy consists of a series of footnotes to Plato's dialogues in which he took up questions like, what is love? Should society censor art? What's the best form of government? What would he make today of a PR agent, of Google? How would he weigh in on the great debate launched by Tiger Mom Amy Chua on raising children? What would Plato teach us and learn from us? These are the questions philosopher and writer Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein explores in her new book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. We invited her in to spend a few minutes here today. So, Rebecca, welcome back.
Oh, it's great to be here.
What a hilarious idea. Have Plato be on a book tour. Plato, creator of philosophy as we know it, at the knee of Socrates. Remind us who he was.
Who they were, yes. Yeah. So Socrates was a kind of gadfly. He was a sort of philosophical urban gorilla hanging around in the middle of Athens, asking these peculiar questions of everybody, important people, young men, slaves, questions that had to do with, ultimately, what's the life that's worth living. And Plato was one of the young men who hung around him, a very aristocratic young man, came from a very old, important family. And Socrates was put on trial on the capital charges of impiety and corrupting the young. This was in 399 BCE, found guilty by his 501 jurors. And then he was supposed to plea bargain with them. And he ended up so infuriating them that more people voted for him to die than had voted for his guilt. And he was executed.
Put to death.
He's put to death, yeah. You know, we so often speak as if the ancient Greeks were all philosophers. Right? They were all so committed to reason. It's very important to remember that the philosophers were social dissidents. They were social critics.
Right.
The man in the street or woman in the street did not particularly cherish what they said. Socrates was killed.
Well, and Plato picks up where he leaves off and takes his dialogues, these Socratic questions that he would ask, crazy questions in a lot of cases, but these questions that would get these dialogues going. And Plato, as we said, creates philosophy as we know it. So you bring him to today.
Yes.
Why, first of all?
As a way of demonstrating the persistence of the questions that he asked, not necessarily the answers. And one of the things I want to do in bringing him back is to demonstrate how far we've come. It's something that's very often said, that philosophy, as opposed to science, never makes any progress. Well, my Plato, when he comes back, is constantly being astounded, not just by the science and technology that we've learned, but by the ethical knowledge, the political knowledge. You know, what? No slaves? Right? That never occurred to anybody in the ancient world, that slavery was an abomination.
Well, you imagine him on a speaking tour, chaperoned by his media PR escort, Cheryl. She gets into an amazing debate with him. It's over personal freedom and whether people are really equal, but it starts with an analogy with orthodontia. How?
Yes. In the dialogues, and of course, Plato wrote in dialogue forms, and he often used these very homely analogies. It's about farmers, or it's about sheep shearers, or, you know, so these most abstract and lofty ideas, but put in the language of very down-to-earth metaphors. And so I gave him a modern one, orthodonture.
Okay, relate that to personal freedom.
Well, it was the question became whether or not there are philosophical experts. And this was a contentious debate in Plato's own day. Are there experts, ethical experts? That's very offensive to all of us because it's part of our humanity to have a stake in these questions, to feel that we ourselves know the difference between right and wrong. And then along come these experts, philosophers, claiming, you know, an expertise, a special training, a special skill, a special talent. And that's where that analogy to orthodonture comes in, that Plato there is arguing that, look, if you have crooked teeth, you take them to an expert who knows how to straighten your teeth. Well, if you have a crooked life, it's very hard for you yourself to judge that. Maybe you need an outside expert. And that's where philosophy comes in.
But a Google engineer argues that Google has changed all of that.
Yes, yes. He has the idea that crowdsourcing could answer these ethical questions. And he comes up with this, I think, fairly ingenious idea of a search engine. He calls it the Ethical Answer Search Engine, and these questions could be answered with ease. That's the acronym of his search engine. And Plato is able to throw a monkey wrench into this idea.
That,
he
yeah.
does demolish it. And often what I try to do, I memorized all 26 of the dialogues so that I would know passages that Plato had actually written that were relevant to our debate, so
wow.
I could weave them in. Actually, I'm still tweeting as Plato because I just hear him constantly. I read something. I'm always trying to weave in actual words of this 2,400-year-old man.
Could you give us a little bit from his dialogues and then from the words you actually gave him in your book to demonstrate to us how he did demolish that argument?
Yeah. Basically, he actually uses what he's learning from us, which is that we've made a lot of progress, that there have been ethical reformers who went against the grain, and they proposed ideas that we couldn't arrive at through crowdsourcing because they were new.
They were outliers.
So yeah. When, you know, the first people started to argue against slavery, for example, this was a new idea. If you crowdsourced, you'd never come up with this.
Yeah.
And so exactly the kind of progress we've made couldn't be made if we depended on crowdsourcing. Huh.
Philosopher and writer Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, her new book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. By the way, if you'd like to follow Plato on Twitter, who knew? Okay, it's her. It's at Plato Book Tour. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
If you've just tuned in, welcome. We're talking Plato and philosophy, and it's fun because it's filtered through the imagination of MacArthur Genius Award winner Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, who in her new book takes Plato on a modern-day book tour. The book is Plato at the Googleplex. Let's pick up where she has Plato as part of an author's panel at New York's 92nd Street Y, debating child-rearing with two other authors, one Sophie Z, who sounds suspiciously like Tiger Mom Amy Chua, only Sophie Z's book is called The Warrior Mother. The other author represents those old-school European-born child psychologists who say parents should do nothing to shape their children, let them discover themselves. And by the way, Rebecca Goldstein, you named that author Dr. Mitzi Munitz. Who is she supposed to represent?
I don't know.
You made her up.
She kind of, you know, I think it started as a kind of Melanie Klein figure, and I had read a lot of Melanie Klein many, many years ago. And so I had begun by having her in my mind, but it's somebody who has a very strong sense of a child's autonomy.
Right, and let them become their own person.
Yes.
Well, and where does Plato come down with these two extremes?
It's interesting, and they actually give Plato a hard time because, you know, I think Plato's position is somewhat difficult. You know, everybody is struggling to refine their views in opposition to the other people. And I think that's one of the most important things that philosophy actually has to teach us, that you have to air your views and bring them to the table with people with whom you disagree very much. Plato does talk a great deal about recognizing the characteristics of the exceptional child and of training it, of subjecting it to something far beyond the warrior mother or the tiger mother. And he gives us this program in the Republic for everything from what kind of bedtime stories they should be allowed to read, the balance between sports and music, and all sorts of things that actually the tiger mom talks about. But he is trying to train exceptional children, not just for the sake of, you know, having exceptional children. We all want our children to be exceptional, but so that they will be the perfect leaders of his utopia, so ethically developed that we can trust them with all of this power. So it's really a political question that he's answering there. Sophie Z in my dialogue, she just thinks, you know, it's the responsibility of every parent to produce an off-the-charts child. And when Plato says, look, that's just not possible, that the children have very, very different talents, she says, well, then it's an immoral universe. Here you are saying, Plato, that the unexamined life is not worth living. And if it takes tremendous philosophical sophistication to live the examined life, are you telling me that some of our children can't live a life worth living? And that is actually, I think that's a very important question to ask Plato.
And does he shift at all? Does he learn anything?
There's a certain opening, but over the course of the book, I think he becomes a little more flexible on this issue. One of the interesting things about the ancient Greeks is that they really didn't have our conception of individual rights. They didn't have our conception of all lives mattering. It really was true for them that certain lives mattered a lot more than others. It didn't dawn on them that all lives, although different, can be lives of equal mattering. And that is actually something, a huge ethical lesson that's taken us millennia to learn, and it's still going on. We're still wrestling with this question, expanding the boundaries of the lives that matter, trying to erase the inequities that exist across the globe. That is something that we really have still to learn, but certainly to teach the ancient Greeks.
Well, it is all here. One of my favorite allegories of Plato's is the allegory of the cave.
Yes.
The people chained in a cave, facing away from the opening of the cave to the wall behind, on which they're watching this shadow puppet show. They're looking at the shadows on the wall instead of the real world behind them, until one escapes and tries to tell them, you're only looking at the shadows on the wall. I love that. It applies so, I'm not the first to say this, but it just applies so to technology today and how we're always looking at our screens and the shadows on the wall and we're not looking at the thing outside the door.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
How do you use it?
It is one of the most powerful metaphors that come from the history of philosophy. And, for Plato believed in our being able to make philosophical progress. For him, this is a metaphor of making philosophical progress. When he has Socrates say, when he first paints this picture of everybody chained there so they can't even turn their heads and see the puppets, much less the world that exists outside the cave, and they're just staring at shadows and they're studying the shadows. They're expert shadowists. One of the respondents, actually, it's Plato's brother, says, that's a strange picture you're painting. And Socrates says, it's of us. That's the way we are. And for him in particular, for Plato, it was a picture of our ethical knowledge, that we are all prisoners of ideology. Plato was trying to break the bonds of Athenian ideology, of Athenian exceptionalism, and saying, look, you really haven't even begun to consider this question of what it is to live a life that's worth living.
You're only looking at a shadow of something that you already know.
Exactly. So dogma, doctrine, unexamined assumptions, that's what it is to be sharing at these shadows. No way of grounding it to reality. He uses a Greek word, akasia, which means ungrounded. It's where we're just cut off from reality. Unless we can argue, we can substantiate, we can justify, we can convince each other.
You can listen to the guy who snuck out and said, hey, there's something over here.
Exactly.
So he wasn't talking about big screen TVs?
No, but we sure can apply it.
Rebecca, your book comes after a very intense debate in the New Republic a while back between your husband, Harvard linguist and cognitive scientist Steven Pinker, and Leon Wieseltier, your husband writing a plea from science to the humanities saying science is not your enemy, Leon writing, now science wants to invade the liberal arts. It's essentially a debate who really has all the answers to the big life questions, science or ancient understanding. Put that debate aside, although it was juicy. What are you saying?
Philosophy is this amazing technique we've devised for getting reality to answer us back when we're getting it wrong. science itself can't make those arguments. You actually have to rely on philosophy of science. I mean, for example, does everybody have equal rights to a life of full flourishing? You know, I would say that philosophy slowly, slowly has given us arguments saying, look, you're already committed to your own life flourishing. You're being inconsistent if you don't expand it. So philosophy often works in trying to show us that there's an inner incoherence in our points of view. We're committed to one thing when it comes to us and our own kind, but we're not willing to expand it, and we're guilty of inconsistency. That's a kind of trick that Socrates and Plato use over and over again. It's really very characteristically a philosophical technique. It's not that kind of empirical testing. It's arguing for inner coherence. But that we can make progress using that. We have made progress using that.
That's philosopher and writer Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein. Her ingenious new book, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away, in which she puts Plato on a book tour in the U.S. Hilarity ensues. Rebecca, thanks so much for talking to us about it.
Oh, thank you. It's so much fun to be with you.